From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
This week has brought more evidence that the Australian economy is coming out of the pandemic with enviable strength. But the week has been dominated by the less encouraging story on the health front. Victoria's lockdown has been extended. The national vaccine rollout continues to be slow. And particularly concerning is that we don't have nearly enough vaccine coverage of those working in the aged care sector, which has seen some infections in Victoria. Labor spokesman on health and aged care, Mark Butler, argues for a much more robust effort on the rollout, and he joins us today. Mark Butler, Labor's been very critical of the government, but let's move beyond that. Can you tell us of the three or four things that should be done now to speed up the vaccination rollout and make it more efficient?
Well, the first thing is there's no longer a supply constraint. For some weeks now, the Commonwealth has been delivered about 1.4 million doses of COVID vaccine every single week, more than a million from the CSL factory down in Melbourne of AstraZeneca, and about 350,000 doses very reliably coming from overseas of Pfizer. So there's more than enough vaccine to go around. We've only been putting 400,000 or 500,000 doses into arms up until the last several days, where that number's increased significantly because people in Melbourne are rushing to get vaccinated. So there's no longer a supply constraint. The problem is distribution. And so we need more going into GPs. We need to ramp up the aged care vaccination and disability care vaccination. And that just means the Commonwealth needing to engage more teams to do the job. They're doing that in Melbourne right now, but still we have hundreds and hundreds of aged care facilities that haven't yet received their second dose, and 98% of residents in disability care haven't received their second dose. These are priority groups. So that is what the Commonwealth should be doing as a matter of urgency.
So how do you do this? Do you actually get more providers to get these services in, or what's the route?
Well, what's been clear, I think, to me through experience, is that they didn't engage enough teams. This job was supposed to be done within 6 weeks, and that was Easter, so 8 weeks or so ago now. It's nowhere near complete in aged care, even less so in disabilities, and they just haven't had enough teams out there doing it. There's certainly more than enough doses of vaccine available now, and they should be prioritised for the most vulnerable group, which are those living in residential care. So I just don't think the Commonwealth had a sufficient grasp of the scale of the logistical challenge, and they didn't do enough.
Do you think that one of the problems in delivery of this rollout is that there's not a large enough public sector to do the task, whether that's Commonwealth or state, that we've seen over the years a shrinkage of the public sector?
Well, the only level of government that really does healthcare delivery is the states. Outside of the defence sector, the Commonwealth doesn't really do healthcare delivery, so they needed to find private contractors to do the vaccinations for them in aged care, for which the Commonwealth is responsible. So the Commonwealth had two options, I guess. They could have tried to come into an agreement with the states to deliver vaccines in aged care facilities, or come to a private arrangement with a bunch of private companies. They chose that. There's no public sector option at a Commonwealth level to go out and vaccinate hundreds of thousands of aged care residents. I think what is clear, though, is that the Commonwealth it has a pretty patchy record on service delivery. The states do this every day, even through private contractors. It looks to me like the Commonwealth just didn't get the scope of the exercise right.
It was too ambitious on what it thought it could do. It wanted to be in charge of all this, but didn't have the capacity to be in charge, you're really saying.
Well, it should have had the capacity. I just think it underestimated the scale of the exercise. At the end of the day, the Commonwealth has deep pockets and should be willing to spend whatever is needed to vaccinate our most vulnerable Australians in aged care. The contracts just don't appear to have been sufficient to scale up that exercise quickly enough.
The Victorian government has said that public sector aged care workers who don't get the jab will be stood down from frontline duties. Do you believe that vaccination should be made compulsory for the aged care workers and health workers generally indeed?
Well, I think it is time for the relevant committee of the chief medical officers to look at this again,
which it is doing.
And I'm glad that the Minister for Health, Greg Hunt, has asked for them to look at that again. They last looked at it, I think, in January. They said there wasn't a sufficient evidence base to say that vaccinating aged care workers prevented them from passing on the infection, not just prevented them from getting sick themselves, but from passing on the infection. Since January, we've seen a lot of evidence come through from around the world about the impact of the COVID vaccines, given that we've had 1.8 billion doses delivered. And I think it is time for the committee to look at that. And if they come to a view that there is an evidentiary basis similar to the evidentiary base for influenza vaccine, which is mandatory in aged care workers must have it, and the Fair Work Commission only recently dealt with a case that upheld the employer's ability to enforce that mandatory directive, then I think that we'd like to see the committee do that. But ultimately, it's a matter for public health advice, and I think we've been well served by our practice of following that advice.
Today it was announced that the Victorian lockdown is to be extended for another 7 days. Do you think Victoria is being too cautious? New South Wales, for example, takes a different approach when there are outbreaks. Where do you stand on the argument, as it were, between those two states?
Well, I think individual governments are understandably going to follow the health advice that is given to them. No outbreak is the same as another. And so I don't think...
But we've seen a pattern here.
Well, we've seen a run of very bad luck in Victoria, I think. This case that has led to the outbreak in Victoria was a case that leaked out of South Australia. I think New South Wales managed the outbreak on the northern beaches over summer very well, but also was probably a little fortunate that the outbreak occurred in a relatively insulated community on that peninsula around Avalon and the northern beaches of Sydney. So I think, I've seen, frankly, from government MPs, not the front bench, but government backbench MPs continue to say, well, New South Wales can handle this and Victoria can't, as if there's some sort of partisan difference between a Liberal state government and a Labor state government. I think that's rubbish. I think the Victorian government is wisely following the advices of its public health experts, particularly given the experience of last year, to get on top of this outbreak once and for all and to make sure it doesn't get out of control.
There's a discussion underway as we speak about Victoria's request for federal financial assistance. What should the federal government do to help Victoria?
Well, up until now, it's really said, well, Victoria, you're on your own. They cut JobKeeper. This is the first extended lockdown that we've seen since JobKeeper payments were removed by the federal government. We saw 54,000 recipients of JobKeeper lose their jobs after that, which we heard from the Treasury Secretary only yesterday, I think, and another 64,000 or so gave up looking for work altogether. So JobKeeper worked. It worked, and it was important, particularly for those workers who don't have access to paid leave entitlements, many, many casual workers who are simply being stood down through no fault of their own or of their employer, and at the moment they don't have any support. Now, Victoria has come to the table and provided support to business, and I think it is reasonable. Labor thinks it's reasonable for the federal government to come to the table and offer some support to those workers who are currently going without a wage. Now, I'm glad that Josh Frydenberger over the last several hours has indicated he's willing to sit down with Tim Pallas, the Victorian Treasurer, and talk about that maturely. But yesterday, he was pretty dismissive in the Parliament about it.
Just on the whole JobKeeper question, Labor argued for it to be continued. But we've just had strong figures today about the economic recovery. Wasn't, in fact, the government right to end JobKeeper?
Well, you're right. The headline GDP figures are strong, coming off sort of very poor figures, obviously, during the depth of the recession. But as I said, many people lost their job who had been on JobKeeper, 54,000 Australians. Although the government crowed about the headline employment figures, that were first released after the end of JobKeeper. They didn't point out the fact that the participation rate had dropped substantially and 64,000 Australians had simply given up looking for work altogether. So I think the government is being a little bit triumphalist about the strength and resilience of this recovery. The Treasury Secretary revealed in estimates yesterday that Treasury has assumed in its budget that there will be 3 week-long lockdowns every single quarter. So for the rest of this year, 6 week-long lockdowns because of COVID. And that is going to have very substantial economic and jobs impacts on Australians. And at the moment, there's no safety net for them.
How sensitive are you in the need to juggle your criticisms of the government's performance generally in relation to the rollout with the other imperative, which is to present as united a front as possible to encourage people, for example, to get the vaccine? Did you feel that when you criticise the rollout too much, criticise the whole vaccine performance, you might in fact discourage people from getting the jab?
I'm deeply sensitive to the risk, and Labor generally is deeply conscious of our obligation to provide as much support to the national effort as possible. And I don't think you or anyone could point to any criticism of the vaccine rollout strategy per se. Now, we said last year that the government should have done deals quicker. We were 5 months later than the UK and the US in signing a deal with Pfizer. We said last year they should have had more deals, for example, with Moderna, the other very highly effective mRNA vaccine, which we've now done a deal with but won't see deliveries till the end of the year. So, yes, we were critical of the preparation of the strategy, but when the strategy was released, we were supportive of it. And I don't think you can point to any criticism of the strategy per se. What we've been critical of is the implementation. And I think the community expects the opposition of the day to hold the government to account on their implementation of a broadly agreed strategy that was based on public health advice. For example, their commitment to vaccinate aged care residents, disability residents and their staff by Easter. Now, I am going to hold them to account for their failure to do that. It wasn't academic. The reason why the strategy had those most vulnerable Australians vaccinated by Easter and then older Australians vaccinated over the following period was to ensure that the most vulnerable Australians in the community and in residential care were protected by the time winter came, because we know that respiratory illnesses in winter are more threatening. We know that. So the fact that they haven't been able to meet those commitments and seem quite sort of breezily dismissive of every single failed target is something we will continue to hold the government to account on.
Now, turning to broad aged care policy, the big ticket item of the budget was $17+ billion over 5 years to reform the aged care sector. Do you think that sector needs more money? And if so, would a Labor government commit to providing those extra funds?
Well, the answer to your last question is that we're still working through the detail of the package with people in the sector. So providers, seniors groups, aged care unions, because workforce is so critically important in this area, and clinicians and so on. We haven't reached a final view about it. But our initial view is, firstly, we're very glad to see some money from this government into the aged care sector after 8 years. The only thing we saw from aged care budgets in the past were cuts, particularly when Scott Morrison was treasurer, and he cut $1.7 billion. So the aged care sector was in crisis. The Royal Commission set out a very clear pathway to get the sector out of the crisis and delivering the sort of care that older Australians deserve. And this package goes some way to implementing those recommendations, but there are big gaps.
So you need more money.
Well, there are big gaps. There are big gaps on wages. There are big gaps on staffing ratios. So they only adopted part of the Royal Commission's recommendations about increasing the amount of care people in residential care receive from registered nurses and from carers. And they introduced that part that they proposed to introduce that part they actually accepted much later than the Royal Commission recommended. Things like not requiring a registered nurse on duty 24/7, 7 days a week. I mean, inexplicable, I think. So there are gaps, and we're working through those gaps with the sector, and in due course, our view about that will become clear.
It's been reported this week that Labor is considering whether it should embrace a levy to help fund aged care. This was favoured by the Royal Commission, the two commissioners, although they had different versions of it. Do you think this proposal at least has merit? I understand that you haven't settled a policy, but does it have merit?
Well, I'm not sure where that report came from. Frankly, it was unnamed, and it didn't really reflect my understanding of where we're up to on that. Obviously, we're going through the Royal Commission report closely. We're going through the government's response to it, and we're talking with stakeholders about where the gaps are.
Just on this question of wages, apart from advocating higher wages at the Fair Work Commission, what can a government do about the low wages in the aged care worker sector?
Well, that's a critically important factor. We know that. I mean, I think it's important to bear in mind that this sector, childcare, for example, I mean, these are sectors ultimately that turn on the amount of funding given by the Commonwealth. I mean, they are in some other countries public services. Childcare is really an extension of our education system. If teachers are awarded a particular pay rise, or if governments decide that teachers need a particular level of remuneration to attract the right people to deliver the education for five-year-olds that we require, then arguably there's a similar public interest question in the educators who are educating four-year-olds. There's the same synergy, I think, between public hospital systems and an aged care sector that ultimately is a public service. It might be being delivered by private sector operators, but it is a public service. And as the funder of that public service, the overwhelming funder of that public service, the Commonwealth Government must take a view about this question, I think. And the fact that the Morrison government has taken such a hands-off approach to this Fair Work Commission case, I think is unsustainable.
So they're going to have to take it. It is a matter of going to the commission and arguing a case. That is how you get the wage rise.
You've got to take a position. At the end of the day, this is a sector funded and regulated by the Commonwealth. If the Commonwealth thinks that aged care workers are already paid enough, that would be an extraordinary conclusion, I think. But if they think that, well, tell the Fair Work Commission. If they think aged care workers need to be paid more, which is what the Royal Commission came to the view about, then they should go to the Fair Work Commission and say that. I think this idea that it's not got anything to do with them is a completely unsustainable position for a government that lies utterly at the centre of this aged care system.
Now, you were formerly spokesman on climate change and energy, and you were known for supporting a very robust policy. Do you think, in retrospect, that Labor was too ambitious last time, and will it take a more cautious line at the next election in these areas?
Well, Michelle, as you know, I've moved into the health and ageing portfolio. After 8 years, 8 long years in the climate and energy portfolio, a time I enjoyed and got a lot out of, an incredibly important area of policy. But now I'm in the health and ageing portfolio, and Chris Bowen, a dear friend, an incredibly talented colleague, is now the shadow minister for that area. So if you do have questions about our climate and energy policy leading into the next election, I'm sure Chris would be willing to answer them for you.
What about last time when you were the spokesman?
Well, look,
No regrets?
We had an election review conducted by Jay Weatherall and Craig Emerson. They came to a more objective view than I'm sure I could give about the role that our climate change and energy policies played in that election campaign. I think a lot of the studies, the ANU election study, for example, found that our climate change policies were, I think, the second most significant reason for people choosing to vote Labor. This idea it was an election loser for us, I've never accepted. That doesn't mean that I think the policy design in retrospect, for which I'm responsible, obviously, was perfect, and I couldn't have done it better. And I'm sure that if I was the responsible shadow minister still in that area going to the next election, I'd have those lessons very clearly in my mind. But we've made a decision to change personnel in this area, and I feel very confident, very excited about the policy that Chris Bowen will take to the election.
Now, you're a senior left-wing member of the Labor National Executive, a past president of the party. Scott Morrison has emphasised again this week that the election won't be until next year, but that's still pretty close. How prepared is Labor for the election? And apart from what you get from the unions, is raising funds going to be hard in these times?
Well, I think of course raising funds is part of our democracy. We're not a fully publicly funded democracy, and that requires all parties, all candidates, even independent candidates, to raise funds. And I know for everyone, raising funds obviously through the last 15 months has been challenging. It's been physically challenging to get together and have fundraisers, and obviously, you know, there's been a lot of economic pressure on people and on business. So I think everyone's dealing with that. We're very confident we're going to be well prepared for an election much sooner than next year, because I think the Prime Minister's been quite cute about his language around.
He wasn't that cute this week the party room.
Yeah, but he seems to be what he was pretty cute last week, and I think his language is changing on a week by week basis. And certainly, there's lots of noises coming out of the government that they're preparing for the option of an early election campaign. So we're ready, whatever the Prime Minister chooses. You know, we're busy putting candidates in place. Anthony Albanese has been travelling around the country, I think, working with a number of really exciting candidates. We're obviously now having gone through National Conference and having received probably the last budget before the election, we're now in a position to start putting together our policies for the next election, and obviously making sure we've got funds that are sufficient to put together a strong campaign that charts out an alternative vision.
Joel Fitzgibbon said this week that Labor should revisit the current way that leaders are chosen, which gives the rank and file of your party 50% of the vote. And in New South Wales, where Labor's getting a new leader, some figures are trying to head off a contest which would mean a rank and file ballot. Would the hiatus caused by a New South Wales ballot have federal implications, or implications for federal MPs, as some of them are suggesting? And more broadly, do you agree with Joel that the rank and file system really should be re-looked at?
I've had a strong view that I've argued for many, many years that there should be more rank and file decision making in the party, not less. I've put a strong view for many years that of all of the Labor and Social Democratic parties to which we usually compare ourselves around the world, our members have traditionally had fewer rights and less influence in the direction of the party than any other.
But they used to have a lot, and that was seen as a problem when national conferences could determine policy in a much more tight manner than now.
So that's right. It's waxed and it's waned, and I think sort of over the last 10, 20 years, we got to a point where party members really questioned why they were in the party. And that's not good for a vibrant, dynamic party. And I think parties of the centre-left need to be vibrant and dynamic and in touch with the community, which means we need a large and growing and involved membership. But I think also it's good for parliamentarians to have that input. I mean, yes, sometimes it's uncomfortable.
And that's really why it was. That was why it was changed.
That's right. It's uncomfortable. It's inconvenient. It means you've got to go through process of consultation rather than just coming to this building and making all of the decisions. And sometimes I sort of get why some parliamentarians wish we could go back to the old days where we just made all the decisions. But I just don't think that's the right thing to do, and I don't think it's a long-term strategy for a healthy party.
But isn't one of the problems that parties, including your party, are now hollowed out? People don't want to join. So if you give the rank and file a lot of say, you're likely to skew your decisions in a certain way.
Yes, I think it's a two-way street. I mean, there is an obligation. I mean, you can't rely upon a shrinking group of party members. I mean, but what I do know is that will become a self-fulfilling prophecy if we continue to disrespect our members and just expect them to roll up to polling booths every election day and not really do much else. So, you know, look, this is not easy. I think we got the right balance when Kevin Rudd proposed a college of 50% party members and 50% MPs, so that there was a significant input that the caucus itself had on who would lead it. I think that's, for example, a much better model than UK Labor has, and we should stick with that. But you know, just because it's inconvenient and uncomfortable, I don't think is a reason to roll it back. And I frankly think it would be an extraordinary slap in the face to our members to say, well, we tried to give you a bit of a role for 10 years, but we don't think you're up to it.
What about the New South Wales?
So as to that question, I think that's a tricky question. I mean, taking the federal leadership as, you know, in isolation, or the New South Wales leadership in isolation, I hold to those principles pretty strongly that I just outlined. But, you know, there are practical problems when at a federal level we are preparing to fight an election that could be as early as early October against a government that we in the Labor movement think has done its time, that needs to be turfed out, that in our largest state, where there are, you know, a substantial number of seats that we hold and that they hold, which will be contested, vigorously contested, that the party machine and the party membership would be, distracted. I don't mean to use that term derogatively, but, you know, it just focused, if I could use that term instead, on a New South Wales leadership ballot. Obviously, it would be very much in our interest that that didn't happen.
So what should happen? A settlement where one of the candidates pulls out, or there should be some intervention to override the normal rule?
Well, I'm not from New South Wales, but I've certainly heard the protestations of my New South Wales colleagues. I mean, obviously, if there was the ability for wiser heads to get around a table, including the two people who've stuck their hand up so far, and get to a position of accommodation where there was an understanding, look, we're likely to end at this result and we think we can sort of fast track it, then that would be in everyone's interest. Sometimes there is a contest between leadership contenders where there is a substantial difference of vision, and, you know, two very different pathways on offer for the party, and in those circumstances it would be difficult to come to that sort of accommodation. I'm not sure that that is the case in New South Wales, but again, I'm a South Australian, so what would I know?
Mark Butler, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast today. And that's all for this week. We'll be back with another interview soon. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.